This is Lou Corbin. Happy Easter to all of you. Today we take a topic under discussion that has been in and out of the headlines for the past 20 years. Indeed, we have had it under investigation on our own news desk for all that period of time. I'm referring to unidentified flying objects, or as they are more popularly known, UFOs. Unless you've been in complete isolation for the last month or so, you're aware of the fact that the elusive UFOs have been popping up in communities all over the country. Today I have two guests for you, both the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena. NICAP is surely among the more responsible researchers in this field. My guests are Mr. Richard Hall, an assistant to the director of NICAP, and Mr. Don Berliner, his close associate in Washington. Both have been working in the field for years, and in the last several weeks have been up to their necks in UFO sightings coming in from coast to coast. An exciting 30 minutes ought to be dead ahead of us. Gentlemen, thank you very much for joining me for this week's tape-recorded discussion on issues in the air. Dick Hall, let's start with you. And to begin with, let's get a background on NICAP. I'm sure many of our listeners are familiar with the organization, and they know that I'm a consultant with NICAP, actually. But let you give us some of the vital statistics.
NICAP was formed in late 1956, originally by a group of Washington area professional men who thought there were a need for a private organization that could help cut some red tape and help bring this thing out in the open by working through independent scientific agencies. Originally, the Board of Governors was included a number of these professional people, and Major Donald Kehoe, who became the director early in 1957, persuaded a few of his former classmates, Navy admirals, including Admiral Delmer S. Farney, to join the board. The organization really got rolling about mid-1957 when it issued its first publication, The UFO Investigator, and it has grown now to be a membership organization of something just over 8,000. In those days, originally there were just a few hundred, and now it's, in the past year or so, we've taken a boost of about 2,000.
Well, I can say this, that I certainly have had a very pleasant association with Don Kehoe over the years, and yourself, too, and I meant every word of it when I said a moment ago that NICAP was among the more responsible researchers in this field. For good heavens, we do know that there are a lot of researchers who are not what you would call objective, legitimate researchers, and we're getting a lot of information from that area, which really retards the course of serious examination. Don Berliner, let's get you into the conversation. Don, you're one of the newer members of the NICAP team. When did you join, and from where?
Actually, I joined NICAP in the middle of 1957, not long after its founding. However, I was inactive. I merely received the publications. I didn't really tie in to things until about 1960, when I was a newspaper reporter in the Midwest, got a very interesting case, got no satisfaction from the Air Force on it, sent the information to NICAP, and then became very much interested in NICAP's activities. When I came to Washington in 1962, my first stop was the NICAP office, and I really haven't gotten very far away from there since.
Well, I think that we've just about established the credentials of our witnesses today. I might also tell all of you that not only does Major Donald Kehoe, the NICAP director, have a number of books to his credit on this subject, but Dick Hall, too, has a research piece on UFOs, and a very nice one, isn't that right, Dick? Is that still being published?
Are you referring to the UFO evidence?
Yes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
This, of course, was a culmination of many years' work, and a lot of people chipped in on this, and we worked day and night for a long period of time to accomplish it, and it is a document of over 200,000 words accumulating the best cases from our files from about, at that time, I believe we had something just over 5,000 firsthand reports in the files, and from these we culled the best approximately 600 cases after putting them through a rigid test, and these are 50% of them come from trained or experienced observers such as scientists and airline pilots.
Well, you did a script too with a professor, didn't you, in conjunction with, what was his name?
Oh yes, Professor Charles A. Manny.
Yes, right.
Yes, we co-authored a privately published book called Challenge of UFOs.
I found that very interesting. Still have it on my shelf.
Well, I suspect the current flap of UFOs, gentlemen, as far as a substantial nationwide attention goes, started in Michigan just recently. Let's remind our listeners of this story, and then let's see what sort of an evaluation we can make of it. Now, this happened, I believe, in the community of Dexter. Is that correct? How about giving us a background on just exactly what did happen to trigger the eventual personal investigation of Dr. Alan Hynek?
Well, the first really publicized sightings happened in Dexter, Michigan. As it happens, when after we investigated this thing, it turned out that the sheriff's department in Washtenaw County had had sightings there for over a week, and some of the most significant cases actually occurred before the 20th. For some reason, the wire services picked up the sightings on the 20th, perhaps because they occurred in the vicinity of Ann Arbor and at the near the radio telescope site of the University of Michigan. Mm-hmm. We don't know the real reasons why it suddenly captured national attention. I'm sure part of it is because ever since last July, there's been a steady wave of sightings. It's hardly had any let up. John Fuller's excellent article in Look magazine about the sightings in Exeter, New Hampshire mm-hmm. last September created a tremendous amount of interest, and I think the press and public were really ripe for something to happen, and the news services were primed for it, and so it hit big this time.
Well, that's Don, you had something to say on that. What was it?
Well, I think another part of it is the fact that it was quite close to a major city, Detroit, and there were a great number of witnesses. It was not just one single individual there. It were men from several different police forces. It was seen for quite an extended period of time and followed up immediately the next night by another sighting of a similar thing that was witnessed by a large number of people.
Did NICAP people have an opportunity to evaluate the character of these witnesses or to examine just the type of person who was reporting this?
Well, we sent two people to the scene.
Mm-hmm.
They spent a great deal of time out in the field interviewing witnesses, talking with the police and the sheriff's departments, and sent us back a great deal of very impressive evidence. They were quite impressed.
I must say that I was a little less than wildly exhilarated over the conclusions drawn by Dr. Alan Hynek, who came up with the assessment of swamp gas. Did this seem to have... how do you suppose he came to this conclusion, or do you think it was really a valid one? Do you think this is what he really thought?
Sometimes I wonder if it wasn't a deliberate move on his part, but I can't really be sure. But this has sent us all scurrying to our textbooks to find out exactly what swamp gas is and so-called will-o'-the-wisp, mm-hmm. which is the visual phenomenon. And it turns out it's nothing but, well, basically methane gas. And the will-o'-the-wisp phenomenon, just the little flickering lights that rise from decaying matter in swampy areas, and it doesn't go more than a few inches off the ground or a few feet maximum, and flickers for a moment and then flares out. Now, we contrasted this with the reports from many of these sheriffs of objects seen plainly to have disc shapes to them. Sometimes there were two, three, or four, even flying in formation and maneuvering all across the sky, and the explanation just made no sense at all. Why he made it, we don't know. There were suggestions in some newspapers that Hynek wasn't happy with the explanation himself. It was suggested that he was pressured into giving this statement by the Department of the Defense.
There's no way to document that.
No, there isn't, and he later denied it, of course, mm-hmm. but this was suggested.
It does seem rather strange, however, for such a an explanation to be coming from a man of his scientific credentials. No one questions his knowledge, and especially in his own field of astrophysics, but no one seems to accept this swamp gas explanation.
No, well, I think, too, I think I reported to you, Dick, I took the trouble to discuss this, the problem of whether or not swamp gas could be tracked by radar, and I took this up with the folks at the Bendix Corporation here, and sure enough, one of their scientists said to me, he said, yes, he said, we do have exotic tracking devices that could conceivably pick up so-called swamp gas or wind or things like that, but he said, I can assure you none of them are operational in the state of Michigan. So it seemed to me that this sort of ruled that out, and I suppose that in the course of legitimate investigation, we have to take all the various elements and make sure they're ruled out, regardless of how peculiar they might sound to some segment of our observing community, you know.
That's really one of NICAP's main purposes.
That's
in
right.
existing.
Well, you know, some months ago there was an incident in, wasn't it in Sirocco, New Mexico? I believe it was down in that area.
Socorro,
New Mexico. That's right. Thank you for correcting me. And Dr. Hynek, I remember, personally investigated that, and he came away with one of the quotes that we use from our desk. He said, "I am impressed with the witness."
He also stated that when he left, he was more puzzled than he was when he arrived, and
right.
had good reason to be puzzled.
I'm wondering if there was anything that he was able to observe in that case that he was that was better than what he had seen in Michigan.
Yes, he saw physical evidence on the ground where this object had rested. This occurred on April 24th, 1964,
mm-hmm.
and the witness was a police officer, Lonnie Zamora, who saw this egg-shaped object resting on the ground, resting on four stilt-like legs, and where it had rested were four imprints, which corresponded with the legs, and there were scorch marks, a scorch bush in particular.
Mm-hmm.
And Lonnie Zamora had an excellent reputation in the community, and Hynek and everyone else agreed that he was beyond reproach as far as his character was concerned. So with this sighting from a reputable observer and the physical evidence involved, Hynek had no choice but to be puzzled.
You remember the Stokes case down in that general part of the country, too, a number of years ago. I remember I interviewed the intelligence officer at Holloman Air Force Base, and he immediately vouched for the witness, a Mr. Stokes, who had allegedly been stopped on the road. He and a group of scientists, by the way, who were in the car with him, their engine died when a so-called egg-shaped, oval-shaped object hovered over their car and raced up and down the mountain area there, right in plain view of them and so forth. And I won't go into all the fascinating details on it other than to say that shortly thereafter, the Air Force publicly stated that the Stokes observation was a complete hoax and fraud. And then about a day or so after that, it was verified that Mr. Stokes had just been given a promotion by the Air Force in his, I suppose, civil service rank and so forth. And I asked the Pentagon at the time if it was the practice of the Air Force to reward people who perpetrated a fraud and hoax upon the American public to promote them, and they just looked at me at that point and said, "We have no comment." Now, I think that when this sort of response is produced by the government, there is reason for legitimate researchers to be skeptical, that there must be something there in the background that we're not hearing about. And I just in those cases alone, I think this is something. You know, there's something that I wanted to ask you, fellas, this. Sometimes when you have so-called physical evidence on the ground, one of the things that happens is somebody goes rushing out right away with a Geiger counter, assuming that for some reason or other, that if we have something that is coming from somewhere that may have, let's say, an implied, and I'm careful to say this, an implied extraterrestrial origin, that it must be radioactive. Must it be, do you think? Is there any reason why something like this must be radioactive?
I don't think there's any reason, no, but a test for radioactivity with a Geiger counter is one of the easiest to perform in the field. All you have to do is turn the Geiger counter on, and if it clicks wildly, you've got something. You don't need any elaborate equipment or extensive training. You can just turn the machine on, and I'll give you the answer.
All you have, though, is that that something in the area is radioactive.
Yes. Well, there has to be a reason then for this radioactivity.
Yes.
If you do have a high level, that means
something
unusual
has
happened.
Yes. It seems that way.
Now, one case where this might be very significant occurred in December 1964, December 21st, near Stanton, Virginia, where a person saw a cone-shaped object cross the highway ahead of his car. His car stalled. He experienced one of these electromagnetic failures. The car coasted to a stop. The object set down in a field. And then after a few moments, it took off and rose and crossed the highway again and shot away and disappeared. Now, this landing area was checked with a Geiger counter, and it was very hot. They've got a very high reading. It was checked by Professor Ernest Gehman at the Eastern Mennonite College and also by two DuPont engineers. So when you do have a positive reading, you really have something. And this is further evidence that something strange definitely was there.
Well, I would imagine that, I don't have to imagine, I know it's a very fascinating subject, but what continually puzzles me is why it isn't given a wider distribution on the part of the wire services over the country, for example. I know that the United Press International is seems to be more impressed with the investigation of this field than the Associated Press, although they do, they sort of... go back and forth as far as their attention goes. Why is this?
Well, of course, this is just speculation, really, but the whole subject started off as a great target for ridicule.
I know.
It was really funny. I think probably all of us laughed the first time we ran into this UFO thing. Also, until rather recently, the press in general, I think, considered it just some more of the same old thing. We've been having UFO sightings for many, many years, and there wasn't any particular change. Now we've apparently got quite an increase in the frequency of these sightings. There was a wave last August. There's a wave this March. Something seems to be increasing, and so this in itself is a story.
Mm-hmm.
And little by little, individuals pick up the scent, and it does catch on. As was mentioned earlier, this article in Look magazine by John Fuller, who was a highly respected reporter,
yes.
No doubt impressed a great many of his colleagues. And then shortly thereafter, when these Michigan stories hit, they were ready.
And we also had, who was the reporter that wrote one that appeared in one of the scientific magazines, the Science Mechanics or something like that. It came up with a story. He was associated with the chief of the Air Force at one time.
Yes, McKinley Cantor.
Yes, right.
Well-known novelist came up with a very good article and describing a personal sighting, which he had had in about 1954, as I recall, and he had personally suppressed this information until recently. Another factor in why this news reporting situation seems to have changed and why more people have the courage to report their sightings these days, seems to me, for the past years, the crackpots or kooks in this subject have been publicized all out of proportion, and this has in turn misled the newsmen. The people they have been exposed to in this subject frequently have not been the sanest, rational individuals, but now they're beginning to see the other side of it, and it's been very encouraging to me to note in all the recent reporting practically nothing in the kook line.
Right.
It's
all
been very
that.
Serious.
I noticed that. I must say, and compliment our own audience here in Baltimore, and thank them for the fine cooperation they've given our own news desk in this regard. And I suspect that one of the reasons they are disposed to call us with some of their observations to make a determination on them is the fact that we have not treated them in a way in which they might possibly be ridiculed. And, of course, we'll continue this. I was talking to Colonel Forbush over in Washington at the Pentagon press desk not too long ago, and we were talking about this, and this general area, you know, and he keeps telling me, well, the Air Force has a very open mind in this, and no doubt they have. I begin to think, fellas, after looking over the Air Force statements, now we know what these statements are very generally, that they've had 10,000 cases, and out of that they've had, 600 and some things that they have been unable to explain. This is a pretty large number of things that they're unable to explain. But they quickly add 10,000 out of 10,000, and they think that's a pretty low figure. Well, of course, if there was only one that they couldn't explain, then this would be enough, I think, to justify more than just a casual look. And I'm quite certain, as you well know, the Air Force is giving this subject more than just a casual look. And we'll get to that in just a minute, because I believe they're enlarging their investigation. But are we really wrapped up? I get the feeling we're sort of wrapped up in an exercise in semantics with the Air Force. It's the sort of question that is being asked. Years ago, I remember asking somebody over in the Pentagon if Secretary of the Air Talbot had ever observed a flying saucer? And the answer quickly came back, said no. And I said, well, did he ever observe an unidentified flying object? And the answer came back, no comment. So, I mean, here we are. Are we in an exercise in semantics, do you think?
I think there's a very strong element of this, or there has been in past years, coming from the Air Force, and I commented some about this in my book. It seems to me that they use the word flying saucers in most of their releases, just as you suggest, to indicate interplanetary spaceships. And many of their statements deny any evidence, any physical evidence, to indicate visitations by interplanetary spaceships. They don't say that their evidence doesn't indicate the reality of something real, solid, and unexplained in our atmosphere.
Mm-hmm. That's right. I just mentioned that they're apparently expanding their investigation, and I suspect that we can gather this from the testimony that just occurred in recent days before the House Armed Services Committee. The Pentagon's top brass went over there, and they were told to bring their UFO experts with them, and I believe Alan Hynek at the time was testifying. How have they expanded this? I heard a little bit about it, but not too much.
Well, on April 5th, the date of these hearings, the Air Force Secretary revealed for the first time that after the Exeter sightings in New Hampshire in September of last year, the Air Force had set up an advisory board to review the Project Blue Book UFO investigation and to see if it needed any changes. This panel decided that the unexplained UFO cases were important enough to justify an intensive review of this data. And this panel itself, the quality of it is very indicative. Some of the members, we have the names of all six members of the panel, and just a few of them. Dr. Carl Sagan is a noted astrophysicist with a PhD from the University of Chicago, and he's on the member of the Exobiology Committee, National Academy of Sciences. Dr. Brian O'Brien, who has a PhD from Yale, is a specialist in optics. He's done a lot of work with pilot training and visual acuity tests. He's also a member of the National Academy of Sciences. Now, the mere fact that scientists of this caliber have endorsed the need for a real thorough study of the unexplained cases, to me, is a tremendous breakthrough. And if the Air Force proceeds with the recommendation of this advisory board, this board recommended that contracts be let to civilian universities, scientifically oriented universities, to study the cases. If they follow through with this, I would say that NICAP had pretty well accomplished its main goal.
I think so, and I think it would be an even more going concern if this happens. When I was talking to Colonel Forbush not too long ago, I said, you know, you fellas are going to get a jolt one of these days. I said, one of these things are going to come down the Pentagon's courtyard, and I said, you're going to find yourselves in a very untenable position. He agreed. He laughed about it. He says, I hope I'm not right here at the desk when it happens. Listen, you know, when President Johnson was in the Senate, I recall vividly that he was favorably disposed toward NICAP, and indeed, I believe he permitted himself to be quoted by NICAP on a number of occasions. Have you folks had any contact with him since he entered the White House?
No, once he became vice president, he no longer issued any statements on the subject, and if he did, he sort of brushed it aside and gave the sort of neutral political comment that has very little meaning.
Mm-hmm. I remember, too, that in the UFO Investigator, NICAP published quite an impressive list of lawmakers who had studied the book, The UFO Evidence. Has this continued to grow their interest?
Yes, as a matter of fact, Representative Gerald Ford of Michigan, whose call for hearings resulted in the House Armed Services Committee grilling the Air Force a little bit, has stated in letters in response to people who have congratulated him and backed him up in his stand, he has stated that the UFO evidence, too, he said he was aware of it, and that it, too, raised a lot of questions that couldn't be brushed off with pat answers.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, as you folks know, the common question always has centered, and I get this almost every day on our own news desk here, on whether the UFOs could be ours or belong to Soviet Russia. Now, can this be reasonably well defined so that we can dispose of it, at least on this program?
I think we can take care of that one pretty well. We only wish we could answer the rest of the questions.
Yes, right.
As far as they're being ours,
we know they've been flying around in great quantity since at least 1944. They've been exhibiting performance totally beyond anything that we can come up with. Some of the things they were doing over 20 years ago, we don't even have any ideas how to do. Obviously, if we had machines 20 years ago that would perform in this way, we wouldn't have wasted tens of billions of dollars on conventional bombers and fighters, and we wouldn't be struggling through these crude attempts to get into space. It wouldn't make any sense. Also, if they were secret, we wouldn't be flying them around all these years where people could see them. And this also would go for the Soviet Union or for any other country. You don't keep something secret by flying it over another country's territory where people can see it or where it may crash.
So we're actually pursuing something which seems to be far in advance of our own technology. I think it's as simple as that. I think you can say that.
Yes, they just do things that are totally beyond us. They make abrupt maneuvers at terrific speeds,
yes.
And they can fly silently. And this alone is something that baffles the experts completely, because generally when we come out with a higher performance machine, it makes considerably more noise than the last one. The more speed, the more noise is a fairly solid rule. And these things outperform us, and they do it frequently without any sound whatsoever.
I think that probably it's valid to observe, too, that if this would have been something, or is, or if it's something from Soviet Russia, which I personally feel is impossible, but if it would be, it certainly would have a terrific impact on foreign policy of both the U.S. and Russia, and they would let us know in no uncertain terms if they were that far ahead of us. You had mentioned, Don, that in the Midwest that you had either investigated a rather unusual case, or did you see it yourself?
I investigated it. I got a call from a couple of people while I was working on the newspaper, two men who had seen apparently the same thing, but separately. They met at work, discovered that they'd had similar experiences, and thus reinforced, they gave me a call.
Mm-hmm.
And I ran the story, sent the information to the Air Force, got an answer back that I couldn't swallow at all, wrote a story to this extent, asked the Air Force for additional information. They sent me the additional information, which made it very obvious that their first explanation was worthless, so they tagged on a second explanation, which had nothing to do with the first one.
Mm-hmm.
So this was pretty clear to me that there was more going on here than they let on.
Was this a landing case, or just...
No,
an object?
A very startling visual observation of something in the sky.
Dick, have you ever seen one in the sky, anything that you couldn't explain?
Oh, I saw something briefly years ago in New Orleans, but I wouldn't classify it as a particularly good UFO sighting. It didn't behave like anything under any kind of intelligent control, at any rate. It was just a light source type of phenomenon which gyrated all over the sky. I have no idea what it was, but I haven't seen anything clear-cut.
Well, you know, NICAP is a very excellent UFO collection center. Do you encourage folks to send you information on sightings?
Oh, yes, very definitely. We're glad to have any UFO reports, regardless of date. They might fit with others that are in our files.
How about your address? Where can they send us?
They can write to NICAP, N-I-C-A-P, at 1536 Connecticut Avenue, Washington, D.C.
Oh, that's good. And also, they can apply for membership in NICAP if they want to, can't they?
Yes, we'd be glad to send them literature.
Right. Well, now, when you make a sighting, we've got a couple of minutes here yet. When we make a sighting, what are some of the points to remember in making up a UFO report?
Well, I think a lot of people seem to have a sighting and not bother to make notes. I think one of the first important things to do is to make some notes. Note carefully the time and, if possible, the exact direction of the object as established by a compass, preferably, or some known landmark, because people can be pretty far off if they just guess at the direction.
And the visibility.
Yes, and basic information about exactly what the object appeared like, whether it was a light source or had some size to it. They could compare it to the size, apparent size of the moon. And the maneuvers that the object went through are important. How far it moved in an angular sense, degrees across the sky.
We could actually spend another hour and a half discussing this subject, and I think at some future date we'll bring you back again and get on it again. But we've been so wrapped up in the current flap that we just didn't get in too much of the fact that a lot of reports are coming in from other parts of the world. This is true, isn't it, Donna? Life magazine had a rather interesting picture of Perth, Australia, and some kind of a crazy-looking light going across the harbor. Did you see that?
Yeah, I saw the picture. Mm-hmm. We had never seen it before, and Life did not include any real significant data with it,
no.
So we couldn't begin to analyze it. It was quite intriguing.
It looked like it was produced.
Well, it looked something like a light leak, however, without a lot of information about the camera and the photographer and so forth, you can't say anything.
And of course, too, we have our astronauts up there, and something always seems to happen when we get our astronauts up there. Something will happen, and there will be some reference to, what do they call them, fireflies or something else that's manifesting itself, and they had a couple of pictures that they thought was another one of our satellites, and that was remained unverified, and as far as I know is quite puzzling, and there's been no further comment on that. So it remains a puzzle of sizable proportions. Well, I'm sorry to have to tell all of us that our time, believe it or not, is up for this edition of Issues in the Air. I certainly want to thank you, Mr. Richard Hall, and you, Mr. Don Berliner, for coming over from Washington to tell us about the work of the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena and discussing the most recent UFO sightings. Good luck, good fortune, and may God bless both of you and all your future endeavors. Next week, we'll encounter yet another topic of our times, and we'll have another expert or team of experts on hand to help us explore its many interesting facets. We hope you, too, will be on hand and be listening attentively to Issues in the Air. Now, this is your moderator, Lou Corbin, saying so long from Studio E at 130 in your radio, WFBR in Baltimore.